The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
We're doing a special show today with my friend, Dr. Robert Hirsch, and we're talking about three crises hitting the U.S. economy this decade. Last week, we did an interview with Marshall Atkins from Raymond James, and we discussed why oil prices will probably be heading close to $100 a barrel by the end of the year. Today's interview with Dr. Robert Hirsch is we're talking about peak oil production and the dangers it poses to our economy if we're not prepared for it. And this is one of the big energy storms and crises that we see coming this decade. At the top of the list is energy. Two other crises we'll be talking about in the weeks and months ahead are the looming debt crisis as the U.S. adds massive amounts of debt to its balance sheet that is unsustainable, and then the third crisis, which you're seeing play out almost every single week, is the end of the dollar's reserve status. Just this week, France's President Macron was in China talking about Europe needs to move away from the dollar, which the BRIC countries and the OPEC countries are doing. What would that mean for us as consumers, since much of what we buy comes from overseas? So listen to this interview today. This is part of our energy crisis unfolding as we talk to Robert Hirsch about his new book, Energy, Modern Life, Climate Change, and Oil Production.
This week was another key week for economic announcements, FOMC minutes, and the beginning of the first quarter earnings season with announcements from bellwether financial companies on Friday. Given the center of attention on inflation and the financials, it was going to be an interesting week. And the earnings season is just getting started. So here, let's do a little bit of a recap from some of the key stories that move the market. Some of the key economic announcements were focused on inflation, as I mentioned, starting off with the Consumer Price Index on Wednesday, the Producer Price Index Thursday, and the Preliminary University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index for April, released on Friday, that discussed inflationary expectations. Overall, the data continues to point towards disinflation, which has been the trend, but it wasn't enough to take a quarter point off the table for the May FOMC meeting. The CPI only rose 0.1% in February. However, the core CPI, excluding energy and food, was up 5.6% year over year versus 5.5% in February. The March producer price index rose 2.7% year over year in March versus 4.9% in February, which was a big drop. The core PPI was up 3.4% versus 4.8% in the previous month. So a big drop in the PPI numbers. Yields on the two-year treasury and 10-year treasury both fell following the CPI report. However, they rose following the producer price report this week. Finally, on the inflation front, the preliminary consumer sentiment report for April showed higher expectations for inflation in year-ahead inflation at 4.6%, up from 3.6% previously. That seemed to weigh on investor sentiment Friday, along with the retail sales decline of 1% month over month in March. Sales declines were seen in most of the categories, which is shifting concerns for an economic slowdown that can see earnings fall as a result. The last economic announcement that had influence this week was the softness seen in the unemployment claims, which have started tracking higher. Claims for the previous week ending April 8th increased 11,000 to 239,000. Stock indices fell Wednesday following the hotter core CPI inflation and FOMC minutes that showed participants are still in agreement over high inflation and the need to continue to raise rates. They also acknowledge the outlook includes a mild recession starting later this year, especially given the tighter credit environment expected as a fallout from the banking issues in March and the bank failure of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Stocks were able to bounce back strongly on Thursday on the PPI report. However, on Friday, we heard JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon say that people need to prepare for rates to stay high and that debt is likely to be refinanced at higher rates, while Larry Fink at BlackRock said inflation is going to be sticky. On the earnings calls for JP Morgan, management said that consumers are still spending and the economy is healthy on the surface, but some of the issues they are monitoring are still on the horizon, and recent banking issues will see credit conditions tighten, leading to a more conservative view on the economy. So overall, JP Morgan had some really great results on earnings and had some calming words on the economy. Now, Friday, in addition to those comments from Jamie Dimon and Larry Fink on inflation, we did hear from Fed Governor Waller, an FOMC voter. He had a key speech, which basically he said that whether you measure inflation using the CPI or the Fed's preferred inflation measure of personal consumption expenditures, it is still much too high. He also said, I interpret these data as indicating that we haven't made much progress on our inflation goal and monetary policy needs to be tightened further. So with that said, the bank CEOs and Waller had the final word on inflation this week and basically said the fight isn't over despite the positive readings on the surface this week in the CPI and PPI reports. The earnings season kicked off this week, and according to FactSet, the S&P 500 will decline in reported earnings by 6.5% according to estimates, which have been up since the March 31st estimates, which placed a decline of 6.7% according to FactSet. So estimates are being pulled up as companies begin announcing earnings. So far, only 6% of companies in the S&P 500 have reported thus far, so it's really too soon to note any conclusions, but it's good to know where we're starting from. BlackRock, JP Morgan, and Citigroup posted earnings that investors responded well to, pushing these stocks higher on the day, despite a broad sell-off in other sectors Friday. The financial sector was up 1.1% as a result, and Wells Fargo traded near flat on the day after their earnings. United Health fell despite strong results, as investors noted concerns over the effect on future earnings coming about as the result of Medicare Advantage changes. Another important company news this week, not earnings announcements, but nonetheless, Samsung announced cutting production to help reduce inventories that helped prop up semiconductor stocks at the beginning of the week. And at the end of the week, Boeing announced production and delivery delays on its 737 MAX as a result of part problems that saw the stock trade lower at the end of the week. Also of note, Bitcoin traded above 30,000 for the first time in a while, and gold continues to march higher into the 2000s, while silver in the mid $25 range all continue to carry momentum following last month's banking issues. While the stock market started the week on a tepid note ahead of key inflation data and the beginning of the earnings season, the S&P was able to finish up 0.79%, the Dow was up 1.2%, the NASDAQ was up 0.29%. The financials were the best performing this week, up 2.8%. Energy close second at up 2.6%. Industrials were third, up 2.1%. Utilities were down 1.3% along with real estate sectors. And that wraps up this week. Up next, this week's guest technician, Ari Wald.
The super age is a coming period for American society where one out of five people will be over the age of 65. Now, this may not sound like a big change in our society, but it's the first time this has ever happened. And the United States is joining a very small club of countries around the world in this new era. For us, we enter in 2030. And this new era will portend a number of unique challenges for us, because it's not just the aging of the population that's occurring here with more people over the age of 65. It's just that we're having fewer babies too. And this will have direct implications for all of the social welfare programs and issues like inflation.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Hi, I'm Jim Poplava. I started Financial Sense in 1985 to give clients a boutique, personal investment experience that's hard to get at a large company. For three decades, my company has been helping families build, manage, and protect their wealth through tailored financial planning and investment management. If you are looking to make financial sense of a complex world, give our office a call at 888-486-3939 to speak with one of our advisors today and let us help you plan your future.
Well, stocks have been going a little bit sideways, but I guess the best thing we can say, we've been in an uptrend. Let's see if that uptrend continues. Joining us from Oppenheimer is Ari Wald. Ari, why don't we start from the top? You think the way you're looking at things, things are looking on the upside.
We think they are. Yeah, the market is in the process of basing how we see it following last year's bear market. And while acknowledging that we're still missing the broad-based breakaway to the upside, what we're stressing to clients is that the strength since the fourth quarter has been stronger than a bear market rally. And for that reason, we think it's just a matter of time before the market breaks higher. You know, we think it's the resilience of the market, you know, through the March regional banking crisis that was just so telling. It's market psychology 101 to see the market failing to go down against just an ongoing flood of negative headlines. It would suggest that a lot of negative news has already been priced in. Now, of course, there's been some incremental cracks in value and small cap benchmark, those with greater exposure to the banking industry. You know, still, it's our view that the strength that we're seeing in the tech heavy indices outweighs the weaker averages. And the tech side of the market is more likely to pull equities higher rather than the weak dragging it down.
So as you look at this, we saw this rotation into tech that began at the beginning of the year. You think that trend will continue here?
Jim, the stars are aligned for tech's comeback in 2023. And what we see is an S&P technology sector that's coming off its poorest two-year stretch since 2010. Over a two-year basis, the sector had made no progress coming into this year for the first time in 13 years, and it's now reclaiming a leadership role as interest rates moderate. So I think the macro backdrop also supports this move. I think the scarcity premium comes back to these higher growth companies in this low growth backdrop. And the pushback is, Harry, we went through this entire decline only simply to see the same leadership materialize. And I don't think that's the case. It's actually the rotation within the technology sector that's helped contributing to this move. You know, what was once leadership in innovation or internet or software has now become a rally led higher by AI and the semiconductor industry specifically. And it's the broadness of that strength in that industry that adds to our conviction and leads us to believe that there's runway for additional upside.
So when you say that it's led by tech, but it's a different sector of tech, where is that? Are you seeing it in semis?
At the industry level, the standout is the semiconductor industry specifically. That here's an industry of the market that was hard hit in 22 during last year's decline, but still upheld long-term secular levels, the longer-term thesis is still intact. It only was a fractional retracement of its prior bull market. It has since stabilized. It broke higher in January, and then something interesting happened. Here's a very pro-cyclical industry, typically leads in a bull market tape. Through the market downturn between February and March, the semiconductor industry was actually making new relative highs. That was so telling to us. And when you see it across the board, when you go through the semiconductor stocks index and you see a majority of the names showing the same trend, reversing higher, holding up, we think that's the charts and the market telling a story that there's something thematic going on in that industry group. And again, why I think a lot of those stocks are positioned to continue to climb higher over the coming months.
Let's talk about, we're heading into Q1 corporate earnings season. It's expected earnings will be down, reflecting a slower economy. How do you see this playing out with the Fed? It's widely expected. I think the figures are over 60% probability of a quarter point rate hike coming next month.
Generally speaking, tighter Fed policy represents a late cycle backdrop in terms of the economy, but not an end of the cycle backdrop. And so thinking in terms of the inversion in the yield curve specifically, which has reached its steepest and longest inversion since 1980, you know, historically, it's actually been a Fed cut following an inversion that's occurred closer to a market top as central banks scramble to catch up to an obvious deterioration in economic activity. We could think back to to September of 2007 or January of 2001. It was actually a cut that occurred close to those market tops. So while there's perhaps recession risk in a 12 to 24 month period, we don't see it in a 3 to 6 month period. And again, it's trying to make sense of this discrepancy between what we're seeing in the market and the economic signal. And historically, while the market can be irrational, the economy can be misleading because it'll turn after the market. And the market has turned. So even assuming this late cycle economy, you know, we can point to bull markets in 1979 and 1988 and even 2017 and 2019 that developed against similar backdrops.
Let's talk about something that's breaking out and what does this mean for the market going forward? We're seeing oil pop up again, OPEC's cutting production. We're seeing on the day we're speaking, RA silver is about ready to break $26 an ounce. We've got gold firmly over 2,000. What's your take on the precious metals here in the dollar?
The dollar's been weak, and that has contributed to the strength in the commodity market. Typically, there's an inverse correlation between the two. Within the commodity space, it has been a bit more mixed as the price of oil is just starting to move into its 200-day average, but we have seen real notable strength in the precious metal space. Especially for that of the price of gold as our proxy for that. Now, the price of gold has now rallied into multi-year resistance above the $2,000 level. So while some see the potential for a breakout to new highs, we would point out that the price of gold is currently 14% above its 200-day average. So the price deviation has become quite overbought over a near-term basis. So our feel that it's unlikely for gold to break higher on the first attempt, but we think it would be in a better position to do so following a period of consolidation while moving averages catch up to price. And we do think select exposure is warranted in the equity market as well. You know, for us, it's more pockets of strength at the industry level, specifically looking at some of the steel producers and the metals and mining space, and even on the energy side as well, a lot of the oil refiners have shown a notable relative strength of late, and we think warrant position in a portfolio.
Now, as you're seeing what you're seeing in the charts and the breakout, you're looking at technology, industrials. Your top industry ideas are metals, home builders, restaurants, medical devices, and semiconductors. Explain.
That's correct. Outside of tech, where perhaps where we're seeing the broadest strength and where the macro trends tell a very compelling story for additional outperformance, in other sectors, it's a bit more mixed, and you have to start getting into industry levels to find broad strength in pockets of the market that are working. So those are the industries in particular where we're seeing strength, not driven just by one or two stocks, but across the board. And again, where we're seeing the charts telling a story in metals or in restaurants or home builders or medical devices and even healthcare services. So what that indicates to us is perhaps one, that the market and the strength we're seeing is broader than I think a lot of people give it credit for. It does make the case for some diversity in the portfolio as well. And I would argue that on the flip side, the sectors where we're seeing the weakest relative trends, the sectors where we think would be at risk to underperform, would be more low volatility defensive sectors, countercyclical sectors like consumer staples and REITs and telecom and utilities. So again, I think what the message here is that the leadership of the market, where we're seeing relative strength, you know, still points offense over defense. And again, you know, supports our more positive view of equity market performance over the coming months.
Let's talk about the bond market, because we saw the 10-year get over 4%. On the day we're speaking, it's closer to 3.4. We've seen rates come down, steepened yield curve. What's your take on long-term interest rates here? Where are they going?
We think for the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield, 2023 is going to be a year of consolidation, that following last year's big breakout in price, it's understanding that the 10-year yield did reverse a 40-year downtrend going back to 1980, But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be 40 years of an unrelenting move to the upside. We think that there's going to be a leveling off of that reversal. And I think that leveling off is now beginning to materialize. So with 4%, you know, marking the upper end of the range, you know, our feel is that the lower end of the range probably comes in at around 3%, you know, that marking some of those breakout levels from last year. Very often prior resistance becomes support. So I think you can have more erratic behavior in the 10-year. For instance, the 10-year now actually pushing into its January low at 3.3%. You know, we wouldn't be surprised to see some action where you fall below it. Some people might think that would translate to additional downside, but then see interest rates snap right back up. So again, it speaks to more what we expect to be trendless oscillations. And in regards to the implication for the equity market, you know, we've argued and continue to argue, it's not high rates, not low rates, it's stable rates that have historically coincided with strong rallies in the equity market. And I think that is the backdrop that we're seeing develop.
And so we're talking about the dollar. We're seeing some strength in the metals right now. Maybe they become overbought. What would you be doing if you had new money you had to put to work right now? Where would you put it? In the sectors we just talked about? Would you wait? What would you do?
I wouldn't wait. I think there's a case to be made that exposure to equities and increasing exposure to equities is warranted right here. That even thinking about what could be risks looking further out in the year, whether this becomes a concentrated rally, whatever it might be, we haven't even seen that rally develop. We still are seeing this market that's stuck between a bull and a bear that we think still needs to break higher. And for those reasons, we are recommending our clients to increase exposure to equities, specifically the technology sector, and believe that that turn has runway following a two-year reset. And outside of tech, building diversity in those industry levels like infrastructure, home builders, restaurants, medical devices, services, and even commodity exposure like oil refining, metals, and financial exchanges to take advantage of the recent dislocation in the financial sector. And building that portfolio diversity with an emphasis on offense over defense.
Ari, given this scenario, what could go wrong and make you change your mind?
Well, the key thing, and if we think back at the reasons that we were positive, even in the fourth quarter, it was this improving internal behavior underneath the surface. The first half of 2022 was characterized by broad-based selling. There was nothing working in this market. And things changed. The underlying characteristics of that downside changed in the second half of the year. We started to see select areas begin to reverse higher and build bases, and now have even reversed higher. So if that were to end, if we were starting to see a broad-based selling again with key areas, you know, if we were to see the case where the value in the financial exposed benchmarks drag everything lower and the NASDAQ 100 failing to hold support, that would get us concerned. And then conversely, if we do see this rally play out over the coming months, and if it does become a more concentrated move, you know, dominated in tech, that would also give us concerns potentially at higher S&P levels, you know, as we think about the back half of the year. But as we always say, it's not just the level, it's how you get to those levels. So we'll be watching market behavior as it unfolds going forward.
And I guess finally, what about geopolitical risk? I mean, you know, I just think of the invasion of Ukraine and how that changed the energy markets and things like that. What if there's a conflict in the South China Seas, or for that matter, in Israel or the Middle East right now?
There's always a boogeyman out there. You and I, we could sit here, we could probably put a long list of potential worries and risk to the market, geopolitical and beyond, financial as well, whether a crisis occurs, wherever it might be. What we're going to be looking for and what our feel is that the market has a pretty good way of sniffing out that risk, that through some behavior of either showing divergences and you're going to see select areas break down ahead of the market on the upside, or conversely, actually see the breakdowns for the market overall. You know, we're going to be keying on those signals of the market, and market behavior is what we're going to stress to help identify those potential risks going forward.
All right. So at the top of the list is technology, industrials, and specifically semiconductors, you've got some weighting and metals, home builders, restaurants, and medical devices. Ari, if our listeners would like to follow you, how can they do so?
Jim, they can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Ari Wald.
All right. Well, listen, Ari, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
I appreciate it, Jim. You too. Talk to you soon.
At a time, bank deposits offer very low interest and could be at risk. Corporate cash accounts are also progressively losing ground to inflation. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we offer a solution to this problem. Our firm specializes in assisting companies by managing cash balances with short-term treasuries and high-quality corporate bonds that may provide higher interest rates. This approach not only helps to manage your corporate cash balances with competitive yields, but also to help reduce taxes through the use of treasury securities, which are exempt from state and local income taxes. Give us a call today at 888-486-3939 to find out how we can assist you to earn higher interest rates with no bank risk and no state and local income taxes. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Our governing elites are talking about a transition to a new economy, a green economy, and the movement away from fossil fuels. Will this work? Is it realistic? And what if another problem erupts, which is the oil production globally begins to peak? Well, let's find out. That's going to be the topic of today's interview. Joining me on the program is author and expert, Dr. Robert Hirsch. He has managed and done many technology programs in the oil and natural gas exploration and production field. He has also served on and chaired a wide range of advisory committees for government and industry, and is the past chairman of the board on energy environmental systems of the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. Bob, welcome to the program. Before we begin and get into your most recent book, I wonder if you might just share with our listeners a little bit more about your background as we talk about this topic.
Where to begin? I got involved in technology at a very young age and pursued a variety of different technologies. I started in mechanical engineering, got interested in nuclear engineering, got a degree in nuclear engineering, decided along the way that fusion was very interesting and potentially a wonderful technology for mankind. And so I spent a good deal of time and effort in the fusion program and headed the federal fusion program for a number of years. I left the government and went to Exxon and later to Atlantic Richfield, where I got heavily involved in oil and gas exploration, production, refining, and utilization. And I suppose if one were to think about laying out his career in some sensible way, that wouldn't have been the way to do it, but it's been a wonderful adventure. I've learned a great deal and along the way tried to share things and simplify them for everyday folks, and that's tough. And I tried to do that in the couple of books that we put out together.
You know, Bob, you did a study on peak oil for the government. I think it was in 2005 for the Energy Information Agency and the Bush administration. Can you tell me what that report revealed? And I guess, given its summary, what did the government do with it?
Well, let me start with your last question. When the report was done, the government didn't know what to do with it. They saw it as inflammatory and I suspect even dangerous, because it looked ahead at how difficult the problem of mitigation would actually be. How did we get into it? In those days, there was a considerable amount of discussion and concern about what's called peak oil. And what that is the point in time when world oil production will reach a maximum and then go into decline. And since oil is extremely important, unbelievably important in our everyday lives, we felt it important that we look at the time in the future when this would happen and what could be done to mitigate the problem. And that was the 2005 study. And people were afraid of it because of the conclusions that we reached.
You know, when you wrote that report, you said ahead of peak oil, the best thing we could do is prepare for it 20 years in advance. The next would be 10 years in advance, and the worst would be do nothing. And Bob, we dodged a bullet in the short term with shale oil because production in the U.S. was declining. And if you take a look at global oil production, most of the gains in production over the last decade have come from U.S. shale. So instead of using that to buy us time to get into that transition, we just thought cheap energy was here and we were going to be energy independent, what in my mind was a major mistake.
Well, it is, and it's a very complicated problem. It's hard to say. It's almost akin to thinking about world war, nuclear war occurring in the relative near future. It is monumental, and it's very difficult for people to think about it. People these days are most concerned, as you well know, with climate change, and there is considerable evidence that climate change is real and that it could be a significant problem in the future. Something has to be done about that. A great many people are pushing for different things to happen. Some of those people push for stopping using fossil fuels altogether, and that would be a horrible mistake because fossil fuels have provided mankind with unbelievable benefits. And if you look around the room where you are today, you look at the television set or the iPad you're using, right now, a large part of that is made of plastics, which come from fossil fuels. The room that you're sitting in is probably has furniture in it, and a good deal of construction of that furniture is stems from fossil fuels. If you get up in the morning and take your meds, as some of us do, those meds almost always came from fossil fuels. It's just simply unbelievable what as we have benefited from fossil fuels. It's just enormous, and it's mind-boggling. And I think if the people who are talking about stopping fossil fuels altogether were to dig in a little bit and look around them and examine their own lives, that they would realize that we really can't exist without the benefits of fossil fuels.
Yeah, and you've written a new book. It's called Energy, Modern Life, Climate Change, and Oil Production. And let's talk about the purpose of the book, because this, to me, was one of the best written books that explained the situation that we're in, and you made it understandable. In fact, you just talked about how much of our world is based on fossil fuels. And in your book, I think you have a page talking about everything that comes from plastics, paint, shoe polish, roof shingles, cosmetics, Vaseline, bug killer, ammonia, tires, paper cups, wax paper, upholstery, vitamins, footballs, deodorant, trash bags. I could go on and on. This modern world that we live in, that we think is so technologically advanced, was made possible by fossil fuels.
Well, that's true, and it's very difficult to explain to people. I tried as best I could as a technical person to try to simplify and make a variety of these benefits obvious to the intelligent reader who's willing to spend some time looking at the details rather than grabbing some kind of a headline and running with it without thinking about what's behind it. And I couple the things together because, as we just discussed, and as you listed a variety of the things that we get from fossil fuels, that really does make up our modern life. And you might, and many people do, worry about plastic bottles as refuse and floating in the rivers and streams and things like that. And those are indeed problems that we have to deal with. But doing away with the benefits, the other benefits that go along with that problem, which we need to seriously work on, is just incredible and mind-boggling. And I moved on to climate change, because it's an extremely difficult subject. And one of the points at the very beginning is that climate change is not weather as we look outside today or tomorrow or yesterday. It's not what occurs when there's a hurricane or a tornado or some kind of other natural disaster, because climate really is average of weather over something like a decade. And so if you have a tornado in 1 year and the rest of the years up to a decade are relatively benign, that tornado washes out. It isn't even seen. And there are a lot of issues related to climate change, but there are also things that we can do. And in fact, one of the points that I made, and I sent you a short piece on this, is we know how to mitigate climate change quickly without trying to get everybody in every town, in every state, in every country to cut back on fossil fuels. It's simply impossible. People are not going to do that. The situation, as a matter of fact, could be mitigated by something that nature has given us. What I'm talking about is volcanoes. I'm not suggesting that we somehow get volcanoes to erupt at our will. That's not sensible, of course. But one of the things that has been observed when volcanoes erupt is that there are sulfur compounds that are put into the atmosphere, into the ionosphere, stratosphere. And those chemicals, as a matter of fact, are diluted, but they're still of high enough concentration that they cause global cooling. And in fact, what we can do as humans is take heavy rockets that we have today and put materials, sulfur compounds, maybe shredded aluminum particles, other things into the atmosphere, ionosphere, and cool the planet in the process. And doing that at a relatively modest cost is something that can be done and can be controlled. Whereas asking people in Bangladesh to give up on oil and natural gas, or even in China, which is building coal plants now, even though they say that they would like to cut back and join the rest of us in mitigating climate change. Those things just simply aren't going to happen. But mitigating via geoengineering, which is the broad term for a number of these technologies, could in fact get us out of this problem within a matter of a few short years.
I want to move on to something that you clarify in your book, and that's that we have two forms of energy. We have liquid fuels and electricity, oil being a finite resource with future growing shortages, and then rapidly escalating oil prices and economic stress. I mean, if we take a look at the world that we have, Bob, everything I have in my house, I keep thinking of Amazon. We live in a world, I go on my laptop, I press a button, and all of a sudden, a truck delivers something. We have no concept. Everything that we get comes from either a boat that brought it across the ocean, a train that delivered it to a distribution center, and a truck that gets it to the store or to our homes. So when we talk about that, they're talking about wind, solar, and EVs. And those three don't work everywhere. EVs don't work very well in cold climates. Not every place has wind and sun.
Well, that's exactly right. And those technologies are interesting. My own experience with photovoltaics in particular goes back to my childhood when I was a young photographer and in those days had a light meter. And the light meter would give me an indication of how much light was on a subject. But the basic device in that light meter was a photocell. And those photocells have been scaled up, and that's what photovoltaics are. And they work very well when the sun is shining. But by the way, when there's clouds, the output of photovoltaics or solar cells decreases dramatically. And we require electricity, which is what the photocells produce. We require energy on demand 24 hours a day. And so if one has a very large installation of photocells, one has to have backup for those cells for when the clouds come or night comes, when those cells put out nothing or zero. And those backups, in fact, almost always are natural gas-fueled devices. And natural gas, of course, is a fossil fuel.
You know, I was just watching a documentary on the History Channel between the men or the titans that built America, and they had a story about Walter Chrysler and Pierre DuPont, and they were building these giant buildings, the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building. And I don't think people realize what fossil fuels gave us more than anything else. They gave us machines. It allowed industry to mass produce, whether they were making cars, airplanes, high-rise buildings. All those things are possible, but they take machines, and those machines use fossil fuels.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, it's one of those instances where if you dig in a little bit, you recognize that one can't simply get rid of those machines or electrify them because that becomes extremely difficult. You can throw into the mix that you talked about the military. The military, in fact, we hope they don't have to go fight in the fields and in foreign countries. But to do that, they require fossil fuels for their airplanes and for the tanks and to move the troops and to produce the weapon systems and so forth. And it would be lovely to think about a world without wars. But in fact, one has to have military that's ready to serve. And that military requires fossil fuels. So there's, again, that's another example of things that, of the so many things that we depend on that are functional because of fossil fuels.
You know, I was reading a book on a gal that used to run one of the largest trucking companies, and she's written a book, What Happens When the Trucks Stop? And, you know, they're like, my own state of California is going to rule out diesel fuel by 2030, gasoline engines by 2035. Bob, I don't think we're going to be able to do that. I mean, if we rule out diesel fuel, how are we going to get trains into the state? How are we going to get trucks to deliver goods to either department stores or grocery stores? I mean, we're really dependent on this. I don't think we're going to go back to horses and carriages.
Well, that, of course, is right. And the people who are suggesting that that should be the future, as the folks in California seem to feel, recognize that, in fact, you can electrify trucks and you can electrify trains and you can electrify a great deal. However, you can't do it quickly because it's an enormous task. And in most cases, the cost of electrifying, in fact, is much higher than the cost of using fossil fuels in the short term. And that's why so many parts of the world are not going to give up fossil fuels or give up oil, gas, and coal, because some people feel that that's the only way to mitigate heating of the planet and climate change.
The other thing, too, if we're going to move to electrification, whether it's trucks or trains, you have to have a reliable source of electricity, whether you're going to power and charge an EV or a truck battery or even trains if you're going to go in that direction. And I don't think wind and solar are going to give you that predictability.
Well, wind and solar that are backed up by fossil fuels, in fact, can work, but then they are backed up by fossil fuels. I mean, what you're talking about, Jim, are pieces of this very complex puzzle and blessing, by the way, that we have that people don't understand. They grab the first line, climate change needs to be addressed. The second line is, I can electrify things. And then after that, they kind of don't pay attention to the details and the magnitude of what has to be done in order to switch over, which eventually one could do with many, many decades and incredible number of trillions of dollars.
I want to talk about a risk that I don't think people realize, and that is peak oil. What that means, no, we're not going to stop producing oil, but our ability to increase it, which allows our economies to grow, may be limited. I wonder, Bob, if you would talk about oil reserves and production, two different numbers. So, you know, the common mistake is if you have a billion barrels, oh, just divide that by the number of years, and that's how many years you can produce this stuff. That's not the way the markets work.
Well, that's a very good observation on your part. In fact, the character of producing oil and natural gas is a matter of drilling down to where deposits of these resources are located. And that's usually very deep underground. And the way things work is that producing oil, as an example, requires a lot of wells to bring the oil up out of the ground. And the rate at which you can produce, as a matter of fact, follows a well-understood pattern. And that pattern is if you have X reserves of oil, when you've produced about half of those reserves, the amount of production goes down and goes steadily down. And that's what peak oil really means. It means that the world, with all of the various oil resources that we have, at some point will pass that halfway point and go into production decline. And there isn't anything that we can do about that. That's nature, and that's something that's complicated. I tried to explain it in the book. I hope I did a decent job of that. But that is the basic reason why producing oil is different, for instance, than producing boxes of widgets or whatever you like out of a storeroom, which you can do at whatever rate you want down to the last box. You can't do that with oil. When you're halfway through the reserves, the amount of oil that's there that's going to be available to you, when you reach that halfway point, you go into production decline. And if the world doesn't do something about that until it actually happens, we're in a whole lot of trouble.
And I want to talk about something that gives the world security, and that is, you know, when you talk about OPEC and Saudi Arabia being the swing producer, anytime oil gets tight, we look to the Saudis. But Bob, I remember reading back in, I think it was 1988 or 89, magically all the oil reserves in the Middle East were doubled or tripled. And, you know, Saudi Arabia went to 260 billion barrels of reserves. They've been the same since 1988 and 89, even though they produce 3 billion barrels per year, and they just say, well, whatever we produce, we find. And I just question those reserves and their ability to increase to, I think, what they say, 12 or 13 million barrels a day. I've never seen it, and I don't think they're capable of doing it.
Well, you've been doing some good reading, Jim. The situation back in the late 1980s was that OPEC changed the formula that they would use to allocate how much a country could produce. And one aspect of that formula was the size of their reserves. And so overnight, magically, the amount of reserves in different countries in OPEC wanted to be able to produce more oil was there. Well, that was well established to not be real. The other thing is that the Mideast is extremely important to the world in terms of oil production. The problem, one of the main problems, has been that we don't have good numbers on how much oil there actually is there, because those are state secrets in those countries. And organizations like our Energy Information Administration tries to determine how much oil is actually there, but they fall back on believing what it is OPEC countries are telling us, which is demonstrated to be untrue. And you make another very good point, and that is that the reserves in each of those countries seem to stay the same each year, even though they're producing, draining a good deal of their own oil. That really is impossible. And it's impossible if one looks a little further at the discoveries. And as you point out, the discoveries are not there to make up for the oil they're producing. So that's really a complicated situation where we are certain we're not getting good information. And without good information, policymakers in particular think everything is okay and they worry about other today problems.
And this brings up the issue that most of the world's oil reserves are with national oil companies like OPEC countries. You know, that we bash the Western oil companies, whether it's Exxon or Chevron, but they control very little of the world's oil reserves and production compared to these national oil companies, which, as you point out, we really don't have good data coming from them. So we don't know how close we are. Bob, when I look at Saudi Arabia, they had Garwar, the largest oil field in the world. I think that was discovered 70 years ago, and that was half of their production. I don't believe it's producing what it once did, and it's in decline, which is a major issue for the Saudis, and I guess the rest of the world that depend on the Saudis.
Well, and you're right. That's a very good observation. When you get into understanding oil, you realize that there are a number of different categories of oil. And in the discussion here, we've talked about conventional oil, and conventional oil is what you get from Saudi Arabia and a number of the Middle East countries. Then there's the shale oil that you talked about earlier, and that is a matter of digging into what's called source rocks and fracturing underground those source rocks so you can get a little bit of oil out. Those oil wells are very different than the oil wells that for conventional oil. And then you go on to heavy oil, like we find in a few places in the United States, but largely in Canada and Venezuela. And those oils are difficult to produce and they are more expensive, but there's a considerable amount of those. The conventional oil, the stuff that we've been depending on for a very, very long time, as long as there's been oil production, conventional oil production in the world reached its maximum in 2005 and has stayed flat since then. What that basically means is what we're producing, we're able to replace. There are intelligent people who feel that, in fact, we have left that plateau and we are in decline on conventional oil right now, which is very, very significant because that leaves us then with the conventional oil that we can produce, but then heavy oil from places like Venezuela and Canada and the few places that we can produce shale oil. So in fact, we are headed into trouble. People were really concerned about that back in the 2000 to 2010 period. And then since nothing happened, they went on to worry about other problems. But in fact, we have an example here of something that's very important to us that in fact has reached a plateau, a maximum, and very likely is in decline.
You know, I don't think people realize this. And going back to when you did your study on peak oil, you said, you know, the best thing to do is prepare for it two decades in advance. Energy transitions take time, unlike what politicians, you know, they pass a law and they say by 2030, this is going to happen, and without looking at the realities of their pronouncements. But you talk about mitigation and where we are today, because much of what I learned about oil, I learned from you and the late Matt Simmons. And, you know, Matt thought that we were peaking and he wrote Twilight in the Desert. And I think he's spot on when it came to Saudi Arabia. But we got shale oil and the price of oil came down. So everybody said, oh, we dodged a bullet. See, there is no thing as peak oil. Look, we're producing more today. But if you look at the shale plays, the Bakken, the Barnett, and some of the others have already peaked. They're saying that the Permian could be peaking, and you're seeing the big oil companies like Exxon is making a play for Pioneer Resources. So the big oil companies aren't finding this stuff. They're finding this stuff on Wall Street by buying other companies, and that should tell us something.
Well, you're right about that, but what you're talking about and what I'm talking about, and hopefully making relatively simple. It's very difficult to do, of course, for both of us. These are complicated things, and you're not getting hit over the head with a hammer, so you all of a sudden realize that you've got a serious problem. And that's the character of all this business. It fluctuates a great deal. Oil prices went way down. Exxon was delisted from the Dow Jones because they ran into some trouble. They've come back roaring back. They're in the process of, as you say, trying to acquire Pioneer so that they can have more fracturing because they realize that what they've been depending on in many cases is in decline, is going away. But all of this happens so slowly and with fluctuations that people don't feel it. And that's why really intelligent people and intelligent politicians and people who are willing and ready to think in longer term need to get at this problem. Because if they do what we usually do, which is to wait until the last minute, we're in very, very serious trouble as a civilization.
In your book, and in fact, in both of your books, you talk about mitigation and you give two scenarios, a 2% decline rate and a 4% decline rate. And God help us if it's 4%, because we're in deep trouble if that's the case. But talk about some of the mitigation things that we can do. For example, Bob, I know that a ship and a train can transport more goods at a lower use of fuel, diesel or gasoline. And I know that, for example, a hybrid makes a lot more sense than EVs because EVs don't work everywhere. So let's talk about what happens if all of a sudden we wake up and we start acknowledging, hey, we're in trouble here. What do we do?
Well, this study that we did for the Department of Energy back in 2005 got at that problem. And it basically said if we had to do what we can do and do it on a crash program basis, like has been done, for instance, to go to the moon or to produce the nuclear bombs during the Second World War. In other words, get regulation and environmental review and just a whole lot of things out of the way and go as fast as we possibly can go. We would then make synthetic oil from coal. Now, that would bother people from the climate change point of view, and that's why I address climate change. But in fact, it is well demonstrated that you can make liquid fuels out of coal, and that's done now in South Africa and has been in process down there for something like 50 years. You can also make natural gas from coal. You can also take a different kind of shale oil. It's called shale, called oil shale, and you can make oil out of that. You can do those kinds of things to help on the production side. But the problem is a big problem, and one thing that one wants to do is conservation and, of course, fuel switching. Switching today is much more believable because of the advent of electric vehicles. And in fact, we can move towards electric vehicles much faster, and the government could make that happen if we had to. And that would be something that would be important for the long term. We can also switch certain things to electric power. For instance, trains. There are a number of trains, for instance, that operate on electric power today. We could build more nuclear power plants. Indeed, one of the basic things that we have is nuclear power to produce electric power. We can do those kinds of things. But if my discussion right now sounds complicated and detailed, that's an illustration of what it is we're talking about, how complicated this thing is. And one of the things we tried to do back in 2005 is to lay out those options. Many of those options are still the same today. And in order to tell people under the very best of conditions, crash programs, how long it would take to produce or save X amount of oil. And the X amount of oil gets bigger each year, as we pointed out, and you just said 2% or 4%. The decline rate could be in that range, or it could be worse, God help us, and then the problem will get away from us. But if it's 2%, we stand a chance to catch up and readjust society and the world and the way the world operates if we take action promptly.
So given the fact that politicians usually wait till a crisis emerges, how might an oil debacle unfold, in your opinion?
Well, we've seen recently oil prices sink low and then pop up, and then they've leveled off in the $80 range, $70 to $80 range now. If there was a war in the Middle East, for instance, that could dramatically impact production of oil from the Middle East, and we would be stuck in a position like we were in 1973 and 1979 when we had embargoes, and all of a sudden, the stuff just wasn't there, no matter what. Those kinds of shocks can still happen. They're not predictable, but they could still happen. And that might help to wake people up. Otherwise, for those of us in science and technology, we hold dearly to the hope that intelligent people, and there are many intelligent politicians, stop and think about this problem. Listen to experts, and you'll get a range of opinions, but listen to the worst case experts and plan ahead. And indeed, if we plan ahead and get a head start, we're going to be much better off.
So, Bob, what can consumers do? For example, I live in California where we have the highest utility rates and gasoline rates. So I have a solar-powered house. I'm getting solar-powered batteries because we have power outs here. My next car on order is a hybrid. So I'm doing things because I see these prices escalating. What can your average consumer do? Because the stuff that you and I are talking here is not what they're hearing from government, and it's not what they're hearing from the media.
And that's where it really requires intelligent, thoughtful people to pay attention and dig in. And yes, politicians have to worry about the short-term problems, but good politicians also worry about the longer term. I'm glad to see that you're going to be driving a hybrid. I've been driving a hybrid since 2008. It's an older car, but I love it, and I feel good about it. What can the average person do going to hybrid, or if they can afford to do it, go to an electric vehicle? And under those conditions, one can have transportation for themselves. So much of what we depend on, as you pointed out before, comes to us by boats and trains and airplanes and trucks. There's nothing we can do about that, because when they slow down and are not able to have fuel to move, then we're just plain stuck. Yes, you could put away a lot of canned food, and so you'd have food in a difficult situation. But that becomes difficult for the average person. That takes a lot of money to put food away. And if you put away frozen food and the electricity goes out, the frozen food is spoiled. That's not going to work. Having a backup generator for your house, in fact, might help you if there are indeed electricity shortage problems. There are things you can look at. Some of them are expensive. Some of them are not terribly expensive, but it requires commitment to do something like that.
Well, I think one thing they can do is get educated, because you certainly don't hear this from politicians in the media. And that's why I love your new book, because I've given it out to friends to read, because you make it understandable. You simplify it. Like you said, it's a very complicated subject, but I think you've done an excellent job of bringing it down to the average person. Hey, this is how it works. This is what it means. And this is how important it is. The name of the book is called Energy, Modern Life, Climate Change, and Oil Production. And if you want to do additional reading, I'd recommend Bob's earlier book, which gets into real detail, The Impending World Energy Mess, what it is and what it means to you. Bob, I want to thank you for joining us on the program and sharing your wisdom. I've learned a lot from you reading your things over the years, and I want to wish you all the best and keep up the good work, and hopefully people will start listening.
Jim, I appreciate it, and it's a pleasure to hear the things that you've dug into, because you're an intelligent person and you, in fact, understand a number of these problems, and that's a good thing. We need more people like you.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. All the best. Stay healthy, and I hope to talk to you again.
Thank you very much.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth management team, give us a call at 888-486-3939, or go to financialsense.com and click where it says Contact Us. If you aren't already a subscriber to our weekday podcast and would like to listen to more of our content, where we regularly interview book authors, industry experts, and strategists from around the globe, go to Financial Sense and hit the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.